I know it's always a little bit exciting to get to hear somebody different from the pulpit here, so I hope you're not too disappointed to have to be stuck with me again. But either way, it is always exciting to study from the Word of God, and so hopefully you're excited and exhilarated about that prospect nonetheless. When I was asked to talk tonight, you know, you start thinking about, okay, what am I currently passionate about? I think that was the instruction given to the other preachers. And in going through that and trying to think about that, my mind immediately went to a Bible class. A friend of mine was just teaching up in Bowling Green, a good friend of mine, Stephen Ogden, on Ruth. And I followed along online listening to those lectures. And so I thought this evening I would try and share some of those lessons with you all, some of the things that I learned. And so that is what we're going to try and talk about this evening. We're going to talk about the story of Ruth. But as we begin, I want us to try and put ourselves a little bit into the story, to think a little bit about what it would have been like to be Naomi, the mother of Ruth. Keep in mind that the story of Ruth takes place during the period of the Judges. I think we're pretty familiar with the story of the Judges, and the thing that kind of stands out maybe most about the period of the Judges is the cycle of idolatry and sin and wickedness that exists throughout the entirety of the whole period. From one judge after the other, the nation of Israel falls into all sorts of disrepute and sin and evil. And over the 400 years or so that this period exists, things just continually get worse. There was all sorts of conflict and war. And so if you were Naomi, you would have grown up seeing your loved ones, your father maybe, your cousins, your nephews, being dragged off into war to fight against whichever conquering nation was coming in next. And yet, Naomi seemed to have an okay life. Her husband's name was Elimelech. Elimelech meaning, my God is king. So even though there was no king, Elimelech's name pronounced God as his king. And Naomi's name meant pleasant or sweet. And they lived in Bethlehem, which means house of bread. And so in this agricultural society, they lived in a place of food, a place of prosperity. They lived their quiet little life together. But famine came, which isn't surprising as we read through the Old Testament to see the famines come and go. Most of these famines result from the sin that existed, the sin that was committed by the children of Israel. And so famine comes, and looking around and looking at the sin of the people around about him and looking at the wickedness, Elimelech decides that their best bet is to take his family out of Israel, out of Bethlehem, away from their ancestral home, into Moab. And so that's exactly what they do. They move to Moab. And there in Moab, they have their two sons and they have their husband and they try to make this fresh start, but Elimelech dies. But there's a little bit of hope because Naomi's two sons marry. They marry Orpah and Ruth, Moabite women. And that's, you know, kind of questionable. Probably not the most prudent thing, but they get married there. So there's a little bit of hope for Naomi to be taken care of. But the text quickly reminds us that after about 10 years of living in Moab, her two sons are dead as well. And so there is this woman, Naomi, and her two daughter-in-laws, Orpah and Ruth, in Moab, without anyone to take care of them, without any ancestral land to fall back on that they could sell off to try and take care of themselves. No hope, no prospects. And it's in this moment that Naomi hears that there is plenty back in Jerusalem. And so she decides to go. To their credit, Orpah and Ruth decide that they're going to go with her. They're going to travel back with their mother-in-law to stay with her. And it's at this point that we hear this kind of amazing speech by Naomi where she tells them and says, go return each of you to your mother's house. May the Lord deal kindly with you as you have dealt with the dead and with me. The Lord grant that they may find rest, each of you in the house of her husband. And then she kissed them and they lifted up their voices and wept. She had nothing to offer them. She had no land to give them. She had no possessions to give them. But she offered them the one thing that she had, blessing of God. And she kissed them and told them to go back to their families and to try and find a new life. But to their credit, they stick around and they say, no, we will stay with you. We will stay with you, Naomi, and we will take care of you. And Naomi says, no, you don't understand. I don't have a child in my belly. I don't have another son for you to marry. I don't have anything to offer you. I have no hope and nothing to give you for the future. Go back. And Orpah decides to stay, to go back to her family. But Ruth, amazingly Ruth, says that she will stay. That she will stay with this woman. this Israelite woman and go back with her. And she said in verses 16 of chapter 1, "Do not urge me to leave you or return from following you, for where you go, I will go, and where you lodge, I will lodge. Your people shall be my people, and your God my God. Where you die, I will die, and there will I be buried. May the Lord do so to me, and more also, if anything but death parts me from you." What an amazing confession that Ruth gives there, that she's going to travel back to this foreign land. And keep in mind, they're not getting in a car and driving down the highway. They're traveling by foot through dangerous lands where there are robbers and there are people everywhere that could beset them and attack them. And yet she decides that she is going to make this journey with her, with a donkey or a horse or whatever they had, maybe even just on foot, all the way back to this land. And so they go. And when they get back there, they arrive in Bethlehem, and Naomi says in verse 20, "Do not call me Naomi, call me Mara, for the Almighty has dealt very bitterly with me. I went away full, and the Lord has brought me back empty. Why call me Naomi when the Lord has testified against me, and the Almighty has brought calamity upon me?" And we read that and we think, oh man, Naomi, you know, she's doubting, she's challenging God, and we think that this is a horrible thing for her to say, but she believes in the Lord. Otherwise, she wouldn't be worried about what the Lord has done to her. She sees this as the Lord's hand, and she isn't casting this on him in some sort of negative way. She's acknowledging that she has been afflicted, that she has faced tragedy, that she has withgone horrible circumstances. But they had come to Bethlehem, it says at the end of verse 22, at the beginning of the barley harvest. And so in chapter 2, the very next chapter, we see Ruth going out to glean from the fields to provide for her and Naomi to give them something to eat. Now you recall that under the law of Moses, when you were gathering your field, you left whatever was in the corners and whatever fell for those who were sojourners or widows, the disenfranchised, to gather up so they could have some food. And so that's exactly what Ruth is doing. And she's working hard. And it says that she works from morning to evening, taking only a short break. And it says, fascinatingly enough, that she just happened upon the field of Boaz. Now, Boaz, we are told, is a kinsman of Elimelech. He's of the same clan. He's a relative. And so Ruth is gathering in the field. She's gathering all these belongings. And Boaz takes notice and asks who she is. And when he finds out who she is, he goes to her and takes care of her because he knows what she's done for Naomi and sacrificing her prospects and her livelihood and her future to take care of this old widow. And so he gives her extra and sends her back. And in verse 12 of chapter 2, Ruth says, "The Lord repay you for what you have done, and a full reward be given you by the Lord, the God of Israel, under whose wings you have come to take refuge." Sorry, Boaz says that to Ruth. And Ruth says, "I have found favor in your eyes, my Lord, for you have comforted me and spoken kindly to your servant, though I am not one of your servants." And then Boaz takes her in and feeds her and sends her home with an ephah of wheat, 30 pounds. This is a lot. She was hoping to gather enough for her and Naomi to eat for a couple days, and she has enough for them to eat for many days. He is generous, and she has the leftovers from the meal. And she comes home, and she tells Naomi all that happened. And Naomi says to her in verse 22, "It is good, my daughter, that you go out with his young women, lest in another field you be assaulted." Just a small reminder of how dangerous the times were. And then in chapter 3, we get a little bit of intrigue, maybe. And Naomi tells Ruth what they're going to do, what the plan is. Because Boaz is a kinsman, he can redeem the family line of Elimelech. Now, this was important to the Jews, that your name is passed on, that you have children to pass your land on to and to pass your name on to. You remember that under the Levitical law, every year of Jubilee, every 50th year, that the land reverted back to the ancestral hands. But if there was no one of that line to inherit the land, they couldn't inherit. They had nothing left. And this was a way of looking towards the future, of preserving something, of looking down the generations. That's why genealogies are so important. And so because Boaz was a family member, he could enact the Levirate law. He could offer a child to Ruth that could inherit the name of Elimelech and inherit his lands and his prosperity. And so because of this, Naomi says, "Ruth, you need to go into the threshing floor," after they have their threshing party that evening after gathering in the harvest. Wait till he goes into his room and follow him quietly. And after he goes to sleep, uncover his feet and lie down at his feet. Now, this is strange. No matter how you dice it, this is a strange thing to occur. People have speculated about what it means. There's some innuendo there, maybe. But what is important for us to understand is that even though there is something suspicious about this, and Boaz acknowledges such when he says that you need to slip out so no one knows that you are here, even though there's something suspicious about this, the point is that nothing happens. That these are virtuous people. That they do things the right way. That despite the fact that something could happen, nothing did. And so she uncovers his feet and he wakes up and he says, "Who is that?" And she says, "It is Ruth, your servant." And once again, she says, "Spread your wings on your servant, for you are a redeemer. You can buy back this family name." And he said, "May you be blessed by the Lord, my daughter. You have made this last kindness richer than the first, and that you have not gone after young men, whether poor or rich." And the amazing character of Ruth continues to demonstrate something more powerful, more significant for us. She could have married anyone. She could have found anyone to remarry, somebody richer, somebody more handsome, someone younger. But she goes to Boaz. Why? To redeem the family name of Elimelech so that her mother-in-law could be taken care of, so that Naomi could be taken care of. And so Boaz says, "Yes, I will do this thing, but there is another who is closer. There's a closer relative to Elimelech, and he has the first right to redeem." And so he says, "I'll go speak to him and take care of this." And so in chapter 4, there's this kind of resolution to the whole thing. And Boaz goes to the front gate and sits there and he waits. And it just so happens that this relative passes by who's unnamed because he's insignificant. He is unwilling to do this task. He is willing to buy the land, because he knows that there's no one to have to give the land back to. There's no relative that you will have to sell or give the land back to with the year of Jubilee. And so he's willing to take Naomi and her lands because this increases his inheritance for his family. But he's unwilling to marry Ruth. He's unwilling to go to that next step. Because what happens is if he marries Ruth and has a son, now the land that he is paying money for goes free of charge to the child of Ruth. And his family loses it. This is a big sacrifice. To give the money, to give the outlay to purchase this land from Naomi. And then to have to give it away. And he's unwilling to do this thing. And yet that's exactly what Boaz does. Boaz redeems the land. He buys it back from Naomi. Knowing that he will give it away to the heir of Elimelech. And so Boaz does this wonderful thing. It's an interesting story. It's not fascinating like some of the things we've studied in Kings. This isn't Elijah calling down fire from heaven. This isn't Jehu thundering in and having Jezebel thrown out a window. This isn't even Shamgar slaughtering thousands with an ox goad. This isn't the sort of story that stands out in our memory of the Old Testament as something fantastic and amazing. You know, oftentimes when we look at the Old Testament, that's what we think of. We think of those stories of God's mighty power, swallowing up Korah's rebellion into the earth itself. Those are the things that stand out. And it's easy for us to forget or to overlook the story of Ruth because it is not fantastic. It is not amazing in the way that some of those are. We reserve it for character studies of great women of the Bible or a ladies' day or something like that. But what is amazing about the story of Ruth is that it's about real people. It is about real people doing real things. This is something we can relate to. This is something we can understand. How many people in this auditorium have lost a spouse? Have lost children? How many have lost their children and their spouse? And whether we have faced that sort of immediate suffering and tragedy, we all know people who have died. We all have faced one tragedy or another. We all have suffered in one way or another. And we need to understand and appreciate that this is about real people. And so I want us to look at four things about this idea of real people. The first is the danger that we see. In Judges 19, we're not going to take the time to read it. It's a graphic chapter of the Bible. But this event occurs during the time period of Ruth, during this era where all this sin and this wickedness occurs. A traveler is traveling through Gibeah, And he is warned not to go and stay into the square because he says, essentially, you will be raped. And so he takes him in and the people come banging on the doors and horrible things ensue. This is the period that we're talking about. When Naomi tells Ruth, it is good to go with these women and to stay with these young women in Boaz's field, it's because there is real danger. If she wanders into the wrong field with the wrong people, horrible things could happen to her, would probably happen to her. This is a dangerous world that they live in, and it's a dangerous world that we live in. We are reminded every day on the news of the dangers that we face, of the tragedies that occur. We need to understand that the dangers that Ruth and Naomi faced in their journeys and their struggles were real, as every bit as real as the ones that we face. We need to appreciate the sacrifice that they gave up, the sacrifice that Ruth made. She left her home. She left her family. She left hope behind and sacrificed all of that to take care of a widow. A widow old enough to where she couldn't even work the field herself to gather food. This is a huge sacrifice on the behalf of Ruth. And it's a huge sacrifice on behalf of Boaz. He gave of his own means, his own property, and invested it for another family, for somebody else. We are confronted regularly with choices and options and decisions of sacrifice, of giving to others, of helping others, despite what we need to do. And in Ruth, we see this sacrifice being made. And as we talked about, this is a story full of tragedy. They lost everything. The tragedy that pains deepest is the lack of hope. And as the story starts, there is no hope left. When Naomi and Ruth go back to Israel, go back to Bethlehem, it's not because they have plans of Ruth marrying off some relative of Elimelech. It's just to go back to a home where there's food. And as we talked about, Naomi's old enough to where she's not even in the field with Ruth. How many years until Ruth can't go and gather food herself? There's no one else to take care of them. When Naomi dies, what is Ruth's connection to this land and to these people? None. She's a Moabitess. And there is no hope as they travel back to Bethlehem. Can you imagine living without any hope, without any future, without anything setting your mind on? I mean, I get excited when I get a package in the mail. Just knowing that there's something, just, you know, I could see, you know, Amazon, I could see it on the map. It's coming. And that's exciting. Like that little bit of, in 10 minutes, I'm getting a box is exciting, that anticipation, that hope. But what if you had none? And we're not just talking about packages, we're talking about a future at all. And finally, we see faith in these people. Naomi speaks of God in chapter 1 and verse 20, like we talked about. I went away full and the Lord has brought me back empty. But she still believes in the Lord. She still speaks his name. And in fact, the Lord's name is on the lips of every character in this story. Ruth herself becomes a proselyte and says, your God will be my God. She repents and converts truly, gives her life over completely to this new way. Boaz, when he greets his men in the field, the first thing they speak is prosperity and blessing from the Lord. Their faith in God, despite the wickedness that exists. Remember, we were talking about one of the darkest periods of Israelite history. And yet these characters that we've just talked about are full of all sorts of faith in the Lord. But the story isn't just about real people. It's about God. It's about the Lord. They speak his name at every turn. He is believed in and leaned upon. He is the hope and the comfort to the comfortless. Notice how Ruth happens upon the field of Boaz. And notice how Boaz happens upon the nearest of kin. God is guiding and working through them. And ultimately it is God that enacts this plan and enacts these opportunities for these people to be saved. He is the one who offers salvation from a life of loneliness, a life of toil and a life of woe. It is God interacting on behalf of these people that saves them and redeems them. I want us to look at some of these main themes of the book. And from these, I want us to draw our points of application this evening. And the first one that we'll spend the most time on is this idea of hesed love. Now, I know it's always a little bit pretentious when somebody, you know, uses the Hebrew or the Greek word for something, but I think there's a lot of benefit to it, especially here. Because when we use the word love or loving kindness, we are predisposed to a certain idea of what that word means. But by using a word that I think most of us, at least, are unfamiliar with, that I was unfamiliar with before beginning this study, this word hesed, we can define it as we need to. We can lay aside our preconceived notions about what love and loving kindness are, and we can look at how this word is used. And this is a powerful word that is used throughout the entirety of the Old Testament. It is often translated loving kindness. But the difficulty in that translation is that that's kind of a made-up word used to just help us understand what hesed is. It's made up to convey in English what this word means in Hebrew. But this hesed love is a chief characteristic of God. Hesed love is demonstrated in action by what is done. It goes beyond feelings and into what is accomplished. It is evidenced by the actions that people take. Hesed love is covenant love. It is a promised love. It is a committed love. It is a love between united parties. It is about a bond that won't be broken. Think of God's love for his chosen people. And as we've gone through Kings, those of you in that class are all too familiar with how patient God is with his people. And so we see that love demonstrated through his relationship to his people. Hesed love is extended from a position of strength to one who is in a position of weakness. It is something that is offered when there is nothing that can be given back in return. Hesed is not earned. It is unmerited kindness. It is voluntary loyalty. Hesed is merciful. It is devoted. It is steadfast love. I mentioned my friend that taught the class on Ruth. He made his own definition of hesed, and he said that hesed is steadfast covenant love, voluntarily given in merciful and kind action. It is the love that God has for his people and expects us to reflect it to the world. It is something that we see throughout this story. It is something that we see spoken on the lips of the characters involved. When Naomi offers this blessing to Orpah and to Ruth, she is showing them hesed love. When Ruth says that she is going to go with Naomi no matter what, she is showing hesed love. In chapter 2 and verse 12, where it says, "The Lord repay you for what you have done, and a full reward be given you by the Lord, the God of Israel, under whose wings you have come to take refuge." We see hesed love from Boaz given over to Ruth. In Psalm 36 and verse 7, the psalmist says, "How precious is your steadfast love, O God. The children of mankind take refuge in the shadow of your wings." That same language of being comforted under the wing of the Lord is used there in Psalm 36 to demonstrate this comfort, this steadfast love. And in chapter 2 and verse 15, Boaz instructed his young men, saying, "Let her glean even among the sheaves and do not reproach her. And also pull out some from the bundles for her and leave it for her to glean and do not rebuke her." This gift that he is giving to Ruth is hesed love. A gift that cannot be repaid. A merciful gift. And then in chapter 3 and verse 9, when Ruth comes and speaks in the threshing floor, she says, "I am Ruth, your servant. Spread your wings over your servant, for you are a redeemer." He can show hesed love to her, and that's exactly what he does. He marries her. He is the kinsman redeemer for this family, and he shows this hesed love to them. Hesed love is shown in this story from Naomi to Ruth and Orpah. It's shown from Ruth to Naomi. It's shown from Boaz to Ruth. But ultimately, it is shown from God to all of them. The story that starts with so much pain and tragedy and hopelessness ends with joy, with a son being born, Obed. It ends with hope, looking towards the future. And there's a genealogy at the end of the book. There is a promise given to these people. The Lord shows hesed love to those who are faithful to him. We see chesed love used throughout the Old Testament. In Psalm 103, it says, "The Lord works righteousness and justice for all who are oppressed. He made known his ways to Moses, his acts to the people of Israel. The Lord is merciful and gracious, slow to anger, and abounding in steadfast chesed love." In Micah 6, this kind of famous summary verse that we use sometimes to talk about what God demands of us, it says, "He has told you, O man, what is good, and what does the Lord require of you? But to do justice and to love kindness," or chesed, "and to walk humbly with your God." This chesed love isn't just a gift that is given, it is something that is commanded from all of us to share to those around about us. Chesed love is something that we are called as Christians to have and to share. This kindness and this care for others. We are to give this to others. We are to share it and we are to show it. Now, of course, this word doesn't appear in the New Testament because it's a Hebrew word and the New Testament is written in Greek. And so it's kind of hard to make those connections between this word and how it's used amongst the gospel writers and the apostles. But some have argued and made the case pretty strongly that there was a strong connection between this chesed love and what it says in Galatians chapter 5 about the fruit of the Spirit. Notice that it's not fruits of the Spirit, it is fruit of the Spirit. And Paul lists 9 words that describe this fruit of the Spirit. And I think these 9 words, this fruit of the Spirit, is at the heart of what chesed love is all about. And so Paul writes to the church at Galatians and says, "But the fruit of the Spirit is love, joy, peace, patience, kindness, goodness, faithfulness, gentleness, self-control. Against such things there is no law. And those who belong to Christ Jesus have crucified the flesh with its passions and its desires." This is chesed love. This is the gift that should characterize us as we interact with others. Notice that as we read through this story and look at it, we see this as something that occurs, something that exists amongst this family, this kinsman redeemer. We as the household of God should be characterized by the same ideal, the same image of chesed love. This isn't just something that we look back on and we ignore. We're talking about real people who faced real tragedy. And in the face of that real tragedy, their family came to their aid and showed them chesed love. When we lose loved ones or see others lose theirs, when we suffer loss or see others suffer loss, we should be right there showing chesed love. When people come and visit at Temple Terrace and they interact with us, the thing that they should see in us is chesed love. When they leave, they should notice that we are these sorts of people. And not just when they come here when we're together, but our interactions with those outside of this walls. Every single day when we interact with those, whether they are of a foreign land like a Moabitess or not, we show chesed love. This should characterize who we are. This love, joy, peace, patience, kindness, goodness, faithfulness, gentleness, and self-control. This is at the heart of who we need to be as Christians. If we declare ourselves as followers of God, we should declare that openly by our demonstration of chesed love. But there's other aspects to this story and other lessons we can learn. This idea of the Redeemer. This is all about taking care of family. Giving of yourself to preserve an heir for another. Sacrificing inheritance that could go to your children to take care of another family. This is about looking forward. And not just for yourself, but for others. Buying back for the sake of others. When we go to financial planners and we go and plan out our estate or get life insurance, those things are set up to take care of our family, as they should. But how much action do we take to set up to take care of others? How much do we set aside to contribute, to help with other people? And not just financially, that is a huge part of it. But every day. What sort of sacrifices do we make to take care of one another? Because at the heart of this story, we see a man, Boaz, who is the Redeemer. He literally buys back this family's name. He spends his own money and his own livelihood. He makes his own sacrifices to buy back the name of a kinsman, Elimelech, so that he can have his name live on in perpetuity. What an amazing, amazing gift this is, given by Boaz. And finally, we see God's providence in this story. Now, this is a hard one. This is hard when we start talking about God's providence and hard to understand exactly how it works. It's hard to think about how God is acting providentially in our own lives because we don't have details about how God interacts with our lives the way that we see included in the biblical narrative. But there is this one thing that we do know, that we can believe in with all of our heart. And it's that God has a plan and that God is faithful to his plan. This story takes place during the period of the judges. We've kind of hammered that a little bit tonight. But during the period of the judges, there is no king. There's no king. Ruth and Boaz have a son named Obed. Obed has a son named Jesse. And Jesse has a son named David. David is the king after God's own heart's choosing. He is God's choice to be the king over the Israelites. Saul was the king given to the people in the manner that they wanted, a tall king, a strong king to win them victories in warfare. But David was the king that God chose for them. And here we have all the way back during the period of the judges, hundreds of years before David ever even sees Samuel, God is enacting a plan to take care of his people. God is enacting a plan so that his people can be saved, so that they can have the king that is good for them, so that he can establish his will and his reign over them. God chooses David as the prototype of what he wants in a king. There's happenstance, maybe, in some of this. Ruth happens upon Boaz's field. Boaz happens upon the nearest of kin. But I think we understand that this isn't happenstance. This is God's will at work. This is God enacting a plan. Life is hard. It's hard for all of us. Some of us have it worse than others. Some of us have faced tragedies that others won't understand. You know, I've said before that I've had green lights the whole way. But that doesn't mean life isn't hard. We're constantly beset by the devil, by temptation and sin. We live in a fallen world full of wickedness and evil and sin. We live in a world full of all kinds of debauchery. And yet in this world, in this wickedness, in this trial, in these trials that we face, we can cling to one irrefutable fact. God has a plan. God had a plan and he has followed his plan. And we can read throughout the entirety of the Old Testament how he has unfolded this plan. How in his providence he has saved not only the line of Ruth, not only how he has brought back to life a dead line to Elimelech, but how he has brought back his own people. He has set in motion a plan to give them a king that they needed. He has set in motion a plan and through David that his people as a whole, even us today, can be saved and redeemed. Yes, we see God's providence in this story. But again, we see it with real people facing real trials and real tragedies that we can understand. We don't have to imagine Elijah calling down fire on Mount Carmel. We don't have to imagine how somebody could kill that many with an ox goad. We know what suffering looks like. We know what pain looks like. And we know that the Lord can redeem us from that suffering and that pain. What an amazing promise the providence of God is. The providence of God to save us. So then what shall we say? What should we take away from this study of Ruth? We need to trust in God for him showing us such everlasting loving kindness, for giving us such a promise, such a hope, such a hesed love that we can look to. We need to look to him who can redeem us, who can buy us back even from the grip of death. And we need to trust in him who is the providential guarantor of our future. Hopefully, looking at this story tonight has been of some benefit to you all. We're calling these events of Ruth and Naomi and Boaz and looking at the way that God has worked through their lives. We need to understand that the Lord has a plan to redeem us through his hesed love. Believe in this God. Trust in this God. Allow this God, the Lord God Almighty, be the prototype of who we need to be. Let his character and his love, his hesed love for us, be reflected in the way that we live each and every day. And let this story of humble people in a dark time bring light and life into the world, your world. Let this inspire you. No matter how tragic or dangerous or brutal the world becomes, keep your faith. Trust in this God of hesed love. Believe in him. And you won't be without hope as you look to the future. You will be guaranteed a future and be promised such a loving future. Thank you for your attention this evening. Hope.